I'm Ingrid Christiansen, and I'm teaching tonight, the sixth in a series of sessions that I've offered this week in Walden about life as a sort of a path, and the complexities of that path. Under the rubric of a couple of phrases out of the Holden Prayer, through paths untrodden and perils unknown, because I do a lot of work with both prostitutes and with people who are accused of crimes for which the state is asking the death penalty. And the sort of stunning reality of that to me is that a lot of the people who are in those positions are there because of the path that their life has taken. And when their life takes the path that it does, they end up in places that we end up despising. So I think a lot about the social production of evil or the social production of things like murder and prostitution because it's partly because it's my job and partly because I've just been presented that a lot in my life. I would like us to open our hearts in prayer for a moment. Gracious God, we ask your blessing on us as we think about prostitutes in our society, and we recognize that we come to this with a variety of prejudices and negative feelings, and we're grateful for all the teaching you've done to us about what your expectations are. So help us to open our hearts. Help us to be loving people. Help us to recognize that none of us is as bad as the worst thing we do. And that we are all beloved children of God. Amen. Prostitutes are mothers, daughters, and sisters of loved ones. They are routinely murdered, beaten, broken, robbed, raped, defecated on, urinated on, shot, stabbed, thrown from moving cars, left for dead in alleys and dumpsters, and society just doesn't seem to care. Society seems to believe that they have it coming. And prostitution is a $14 billion business in the U.S., serving 1.5 million clients each week. Wow. So it's big. There's a lot of people involved in this. The $14 billion business, the numbers have grown. Prostitution is really taking the place of drugs in some ways as a way of making money. A lot of prostitutes are imported internationally now, and Chicago is one of the big ports of entry. I have a lot of things I want to get through tonight, so I'm going to go through some of them quickly, and then I hope we'll have some discussion. The only thing that I really want to do by the end of the night, I'm willing to skip some of my 11 things I'm hoping to do, but I don't want to do number 11. So when it gets to be a few minutes before the end, I'll jump to 11 if we're not there yet. But we can already tick off pray and quote, so we're on 3. What a satisfying feeling. I think that there's a lot of mythology around prostitution, and it probably comes from the fact that we call it the oldest profession, and because it's so rife and rampant in the Bible. I went into a concordance and just pulled out these, I don't know how many lines this is, but these many references and looked them up. And, you know, that was not all of them. The language around prostitution in the Bible even is complicated. It's a whore, a concubine, a harlot. Then, of course, we call them call girls and hookers. There's a lot of language around prostitution. And there's a lot of mythology around it. So it is something that sort of goes to some old place in us. The Bible is nice about prostitution because For one thing, Jesus seems to have a soft spot in his heart. The stories are complicated. Prostitutes are seldom just perfectly dissed in the Bible. They're often clever, or they're not really prostitutes. They're some other way of using their sexuality to get a good end, like in Rahab's case. Or they're maybe not really prostitutes, like Mary Magdalene is always thought to be a prostitute, and I don't know, I mean, I'm not a biblical scholar, so I have no idea whether she probably is or probably isn't, but I think that the message that you get, if you sum up a lot of these biblical references, is that it's complicated, at the very least. And I found that helpful to see. I wanted to just sort of talk about violence for just a second, to put it sort of in the back of your mind and have you think about that there are lots of kinds of violence, and one of them is emotional degradation. That is certainly something that prostitutes tell you they experience on a daily basis. I've interviewed probably 1,000 prostitutes, and I know one prostitute who's not a drug addict. And she says, she has a great line actually. She's a middle-aged Latino woman, very good looking, graying hair, tidy, well gotten together. And I said to her, well, because she was in a class of court-referred prostitutes. She was caught in the act. She was a prostitute. I said to her, she said, I'm not a drug addict. I don't do drugs. I don't drink alcohol. And you could see she didn't. She looked healthy. I said, well, why are you doing prostitution? And she said, I just love penises. And then she turned to me and she said, it's a sickness.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an interesting line, and I think she's probably right. I mean, the kind of addiction. She was she was describing a sexual addiction, which is probably not fair to make fun of, but it was a very funny moment. I had a hard time keeping a straight face. But I think the emotional degradation goes to the drug addiction. It's a chicken and egg question, maybe. You could say, of the prostitutes that we interview who come into Genesis House, where I chair the board, about 50% of them say they were a drug addict first and a prostitute second, so they prostitute in order to support their habit. And the other 50% say they prostituted first, but they can't prostitute themselves without being a drug addict because it's so humiliating and degrading and inhuman. All those things I read to you that happen to prostitutes. So the emotional destruction of a human being is, I would maintain, every bit as violent as the physical destruction. There's another kind of violence that happens to them. That's what I just described. Okay, I've done B, which is the need to anesthetize your feelings or numb yourself, which is this mostly done through drugs. And then the third kind of violence that they experience a lot is physical. I know a lot of prostitutes whose bodies are broken in some way. I read a statistic once, 85% of all prostitutes are abused physically or have experienced violence in the course of their work. And I thought to myself, yeah, there's 85% so far, but the other 15% surely will be, because that's such an expression of sexuality by some people, is the need to degrade someone through hurting them. But there are lots of redemptive little stories. One of my favorites is a story of a prostitute who was thrown out of a moving car and dragged, and she was really very badly injured and ended up being in the hospital for several months. But who saved her was a city bus driver who stopped his bus and got passengers to help him get her on board and announced to the bus, we're going to the hospital. And so there are things like that that happen. There's a lot of niceness in some of these stories. One of the most terrifying stories that I ever experienced was when my children were at the age of the two young women I'm going to tell you about. So of course it hit me harder. I was in a drunk tank in a prison, a lockup in a jail, doing a rap to the women before they go before the judge, telling them about the services of this agency, Genesis House, that helps prostitutes. And then they have a choice at the end of that of going back out into the general population or staying and talking longer with me if they want to. And two young girls who were 15 stopped and came to the window and talked through the glass hole longer with me. I said to them, why are you here? Because it was an adult jail. And they said, because we lied about our ages. Duh. Because you could see how young they were. And I said, why did you do that? And they said, because we can't be sent home because of all the violence in our homes, basically. I'm summarizing for you, but it was the truth, you know, that they would be further raped, further beat up in their own homes. It was safer on the streets. I said, how long have you been working on the streets? And it was a relatively short time. They had run away together. It was something like 6 weeks. The statistical numbers on youth runaways vary between 2 days, 48 hours, and 7.5 days before they turn their first trick. So statistically, a runaway is in great peril for being captured into the sort of network, the circle of prostitution. I said to these children, I said, what neighborhood do you work in? And they said, we work Belmont and Clark, which is about a mile from my house. And it's where my kids sometimes go to the donut shop and where a lot of kids hang out on the street. And I said, what are your names? And they said, one of them was Tragedy and the other one was Angel. And I said, do you know that, because it's never in the news, I said, do you know that there's someone who's killing prostitutes on that beat, in that neighborhood? And I started to describe him. I said, he's a such and such a man, age, description. And I said, he kills by strangling. And one of them said, oh, I've had him. And I said, what do you mean you've had him? And she said, well, we take turns doing tricks. And Tragedy watches me when I'm doing a trick in a car or in an alley. And so we protect each other. And she had on a zippered thing like this, a turtleneck. And she unzipped it and showed me the marks, the finger marks around her neck, the black and blue finger marks. And she said, he got me and was strangling me, and she was watching, Tragedy was watching, and ran to the car and opened the door and dragged me out, safely. And I said, do you kids know that you're gonna die if you stay out here? You can't stay out here. And they said, oh, we know lots of dead people. You know, they have friends who've been killed. So, you know, I tried to talk them into coming in and promising not to turn them over to youth services. They never came in. So the youth business is a big part of it. The average age of a woman getting into prostitution is 14. So often she's turned out by a family member, turned out as sort of put on the street, put to work. If she's not turned out, she goes out because of a running away from something. A 14-year-old doesn't choose to be a prostitute. They're forced to, or they're doing it for survival reasons. But that's the average age, which means people start younger than that. And of course, they're boys and girls. Working women is a sort of interesting issue. When you think about all the things that working women want and need, they need childcare. Prostitutes can work during the school day and they can work at night when their kids are in bed. So it meets that need. What they don't have is the stuff that a lot of working women don't get. They don't have insurance, they don't have childcare, they don't have education. I would say half of the prostitutes that come into Genesis House, which is the biggest prostitute social service agency in the country, can't read. So, you know, they've gone through some schooling, but not enough to produce a competent reader. So if you think about the social production of prostitution, you would have to think about having been abused or assaulted as a child, which about 95% of them have been. You think about being in a school system where the education is terrible, so you don't have other options, really, to do work. You think about a climate of an attitude toward women that says that their appearance and their bodies are saleable commodities, and that that's something that we would like to have as at our disposal as a society, is the women that we can use in that way. There are a lot of things about prostitution that are like a factory. You know, if you start at this end and have a pipeline, and you begin with an infant, if you have abuse or neglect as in infancy, if you send him to a terrible school system, if you have a society that treats women as objects, and if you don't have ways of remedying the education to provide jobs, then you have prostitution. A girl that I have been friends with since she was born, and who is a prostitute now, and she's about 27 or something, said to me once, "Ingrid, there are the big three for people like me." She was from a very poor family in a very rough neighborhood. And from a family that was very smart, most of the 13 kids in this family have perfect attendance records in school. It's a family where my husband and I tried to get three of the kids into college, and they all had perfect attendance records in school and good grades and had graduated from high school. And when we got them into college, the first thing the college did was give a literacy test, and they failed it. Mm-hmm. So none of them went to school. None of them went on to school. But another one of the kids, not one of these ones that we tried to get going into college, actually two of the kids in that family have made it and are workers that are doing well. But the other 11 are not. And this one, who is a prostitute, said, "There are the big three for people like me." And I said, "What do you mean the big three?" And she said, "Well, if you have children and if you need to support yourself, there are three things you can do in my neighborhood." These numbers have increased since September 11th. So it's where these problems have, our numbers at Genesis House have increased since September 11th. So it's this thing I'm about to say affects more people. She said, "You can become a thief, a robber, you can steal, you can learn to steal." She said, "But it's hard." She said, "I can't do it, I don't know how. It's too complicated. You know, if you're gonna be, you have to have really good hands to be a pickpocket, or you're gonna be a second story man and learn to climb into people's houses and steal stuff, or you're gonna be a con person and learn how to set, you know, get one bottle of scotch and pretend it's a whole case and put tea in the rest of the bottles." Or I mean, she said all the ways of stealing are so hard, she can't figure it out. She said, "Two, you can become a drug dealer to make money." And she said, "If you become a drug dealer, you become your own enemy. You become the enemy of your neighbors, of your relatives, of your children. You become your own worst enemy." And she said, "That's too destroying of spirit. Because you end up killing your own kids and your nieces and nephews and your cousins and your neighbors. Because if you're a drug dealer, if you're the neighborhood drug dealer, you're the bad guy that everybody loves to hate." So then she said, "The third thing you can do, if you have no other options," as she viewed herself having, "is to what she called lay down with a man." She said, "That's the one you would do, Ingrid." But it's interesting, you know, that she made that judgment about my character. She said, "If I were in her shoes, I would become a prostitute." And, you know, she's probably right. So with people facing that kind of poverty and that kind of social structure, now, of course, not everyone that's born into those conditions becomes a prostitute. So there are other solutions, but I think that that's a major thing in prostitution. The Homeless Society in Chicago says that 84% of all prostitutes have been homeless at some point in their life. So homelessness and prostitution have a big nexus. There are 50,000 prostitutes in Chicago at any given time. That's where I live, so I'm interested in that number. 95 to 99% are chemically dependent. As I told you, I've interviewed 1,000 prostitutes, and I know that one who's not. This is an interesting statistic. 66% of all prostitutes, now who knows where they get these numbers? You know, how do you interview enough prostitutes to have a really good sample? But somebody did a lot of work on it and said that 66% of them have post-traumatic stress syndrome. And they compared that with Vietnam vets and said that about, I think it's 30% or so of them do. Because it's just so traumatic. I mean, you're making yourself so vulnerable to people who are quite often hostile. So there's a lot of PTSD. Of course, that's a, who said to me before class? Was it Ann? Was it you? You did, Lauren. Why don't you repeat that?
Oh, about the political?
Yeah.
It was in a book I read called Trauma and Recovery. I forget the name of the author. I think it's kind of a classic, but she said for that diagnosis to become socially sanctioned, it takes a political movement in order to
PTSD,
clear it away.
Right. Because in the courts, it's not given a lot of honor and it's not funded well. I mean, PTSD, we all know it exists, but it's not official enough yet. It's not like saying, well, I'm schizophrenic or something. I told you that 14 is the average age that people enter prostitution, between 48 hours and 9 days on the street for youth, and they've turned their first trick. Somebody did research and found that 90% are survivors of incest, sexual assault, or rape. I think it's higher. I think 90% is low. So that's some kind of background on prostitutes.
Uh-huh. How about AIDS? There must be a huge percentage now that AIDS.
A lot of prostitutes have AIDS. But a lot of them take some pride in not having sexually transmitted diseases and in being able to use dental dams and condoms and female condoms in a way that keeps them safe. And they feel like they get a bad rap for spreading disease when they feel like the men are spreading disease to them, but that they are trying to prevent that. But obviously a lot of prostitutes have that. There are a lot of different kinds of prostitutes. The probably the simplest way to slide into it is for a lot of women who receive welfare checks or have other marginal sources of income. In the last half of the month, they do this thing called laying down with a man. Another member of the same family of 13 kids that I referred to earlier described to me once how at the end of the month she always said to her husband, I'm going to visit my cousin, because their cupboards were bare and they have children. And so she couldn't stand the hunger. And so she'd say, I'm going to visit my cousin. And she said, it was just heartbreaking. She said to me, and he turns his face to the wall. So then she does what she can do. She comes back 2 days later, she's got some money, she's got the groceries. So that's one kind of prostitution. And of course they never call themselves prostitutes. They just say they do what they have to do to feed their kids. And some of those people may not be drug addicted. A really, really common in Chicago kind of prostitute is somebody who does a $5 blowjob. And that's always a crack addict. And there's always a crack house within about 2 blocks, and you can always get a hit of crack for $5. And there are women who've told me, I'll do a blowjob for $3 if I have $2 in my pocket already. So some of the old high-class prostitutes feel that the advent of crack into our society has ruined the business. Because all those whores out there that'll do a $5 blowjob, you know. But that isn't the only kind of prostitution, but that is a very common kind. And so if you do a $5 blowjob, I mean, how much time do you have to spend to get enough money to buy groceries for your kids? You know, first you have to satisfy your addiction. They get up in the morning and they have their sick on, they're sniffing and they're shaky and they're looking for to satisfy their addiction. And then they say, as soon as they get their sick off, in other words, they've gone to the crack house and had some crack, cocaine, then they can go out and lead a normal life for 6 hours or something, and then they get their sick on again. I can't tell you how many people I know who are in that daily grind. Just, that's the only thing that matters in their life, is to get their sick off. But there are a lot of people who do the sort of $20 to $200 prostitution, which is usually with a pimp. Then there's no pimps involved in this $5 blowjob business. There's no money for a pimp. You know, there's no money. There's no space between you and getting your sick off to include a pimp. But people who start out higher class can do $20 to $200, and that might involve going into a room somewhere. It might involve some other kinds of sex than a blowjob. Certainly a nicer street. And those would be the streets that that are petitioning their aldermen and that are marching and that are out at night with searchlights and, you know, that are really making a fuss about prostitution in their neighborhood. You know, and I'm not blaming them, I'm just saying that those are the people, you know, slightly higher class or middle class people who don't want, in Chicago, who don't want people like that around. And then there's brothels, you know, that have madams and the houses of prostitution where you live and where somebody takes care of you to some extent and where you sort of take care of each other. In Chicago, really the most money you can make if you're young and pretty is as a call girl. And we have something in Chicago called The Reader, which is a free weekly magazine that has great stories, and it does good research, and I read it every week. But it has a whole section of want ads, you know, that's where everybody puts their apartment for rent and stuff like that. But the want ads have about 3 pages of call girls. You know, and they're all called something a little nicer than call girl, but that's what they are. They're call girls. And so it's escort services, things like that. And they sound so innocent, you know, college girls, you know, business women, escort service. Those are all prostitutes, and they all make significant money. I know a couple of women, I know actually a fair number of women who've made lots of money that way for quite a few years. But they do begin to use drugs because, again, it's too degrading not to. And then there's an inevitable fall. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. If you stay in the business, you go down. First, you lose your appearance, your addiction grows, and your self-esteem is degraded, and you're soon working the streets and working street corners, and, you know, it goes from bad to worse. An interesting thing that I wanted to tell you about prostitutes is that I've taught women's studies for years to college students. And my students seem to be very confused about rape. They're not sure when they've been raped. It's a shocking thing to me. But date rape, you know, is epidemic in colleges, or rape when somebody puts a sleeping tablet or some kind of drug in your drink, and what is it called?
Ecstasy
or something like that. Oh, ecstasy. It destroys brain.
No, ecstasy.
Prohypnol.
Prohypnol. Prohypnol. Ecstasy.
Ecstasy is something else. That destroys brain cells.
Ecstasy is fairly benign compared to a lot of drugs. But it is not.
I have a client on death row who's recently been told that a quarter of his brain is gone from ecstasy. So prostitutes know the difference among love, sex, and rape, because they contract very specifically for certain sex acts. They don't, almost all prostitutes that I know don't kiss, because kissing is too intimate, interestingly enough. The last week in Bible study, we had a prostitute who wore a thing over her head, a veil or something, and the rabbi asked me to figure out ways in which that prostitute, what contemporary prostitutes would say about that prostitute. And one of the things was, they would totally understand that veil. They would say, you're already so anonymous and so unseen, you're so invisible in society, but they don't kiss. So the veil wouldn't make any difference because their mouth is, they don't need it. So the difference between love, and so they have someone that they love, that they go home to, that they hold, that they kiss, that they cherish. Frequently, actually, a lesbian partner, because I think there's a clear contrast between my work life and my love life that way. So love is one thing, sex is another thing, and sex is business. And you describe specific sex acts. These are prostitutes who are the $20 to the $200 and the call girl type, not the $5 type. You say you'll do this, this, and this for this amount of money. If you want something in addition, you have to pay more. And rape. So they, it's almost impossible if you've been raped and you're known to have done any prostituting for the police to take it seriously, and you never would have that case tried in court. But they're very clear. I mean, if I would say to them, well, I was out with my boyfriend, and I drank a little too much, and we started kissing, and then he had sex with me even though I was saying no, or I was too drunk to consent, or I was unconscious or something. I mean, they just think that's crazy. I mean, they think that's rape. They're very clear about what rape is. So their experience is helpful. I've actually had a prostitute come to my women's studies class and talk about that. And then I had her talk about her prostitution too. There are two general points of view. Am I going too fast? I feel like I'm sort of racing through this, but I have so many things I want to say about it. There are two general points of view about prostitution. One is that, is really the book, Frederic Delacoste's book called Sex Work, is a wonderful book embodying one point of view. It's quite a big, thick, wonderful book, entirely written by prostitutes, little snippets, half a page, 2 pages, stories that prostitutes have written and sent to Frederic Delacoste. She just sent out word all across the country in places where prostitutes gather, I want to hear from you in your own words. And people sent her stuff. And she published it in this book called Sex Work. And really what that book talks about is how prostitution is empowering and claiming of yourself. And especially if you've been a victim of sexual abuse as a child, of a sort of reclaiming of your sexuality and getting control of it. And it's a control issue. It's getting back in the driver's seat and saying, I will only do these 3 sex acts and I will only do them for this amount of money. So, screw you, Dad, you know, when I didn't have any choice and dared to do whatever you said, or whoever it is that was sexually abusing her as a child. So some people feel that for them, prostitution is a kind of empowering kind of thing. And who am I to say they're wrong? I don't think they're going to stay in that place forever because I think it's too eroding of, it's too acidic in your soul. I just can't see people staying in that place. But I think it's honestly true that a number of people have that experience. And maybe when they're satisfied that they're back in control, they get out of the life. They go into something else. That certainly happens to people. Certainly the more common kind of prostitute that you see is someone who is the victim, and that's pretty much the person I've been describing. But what I'd like to say about victims is that my constant, and I guess this is a sin, surprise, is what whole people they are, in spite of all of this stuff. In spite of their addictions, in spite of the erosion of their soul. So that when I've spent time volunteering in a drop-in center for prostitutes, or when I spend time walking the streets with another person, handing out condoms and talking to people and offering support, what I find is incredible generosity and gifts of all kinds, talents, things they can do, things they like to do. I'm going to tell you about a few people quickly for whom that's true. One of the first prostitutes I ever met was a woman called Pamela. I was walking the streets of the west side of Chicago with a staff person from Genesis House and handing out condoms and connecting with people. And I was pretty green and I was pretty frightened and not sure what I was getting into. And I sat down one day and came home and wrote a thing about what had happened to me that day. And I wrote, all the women on the west side are black, and all of them dress pretty much like a boy and walk fast on the street and off suddenly. The street will be empty one minute, and a, quote, girl looking like a boy will materialize, talk to us, take some condoms, get in a car, and be off with some guy. But sometimes with pain. Today, Pamela, dancing around us, looking slant-eyed, said to Sabrina that she was still waiting to come in. But she would come in this month. It was on her mind. Sabrina hugged her, and Pamela's face started to crack. A tear came, a sudden sob gasped out of her. And then she was off with a pirouette. A quarter of a block later, I heard my name, and I turned. A little dance step, and it's good to meet you too, Ingrid. I never saw her again. She was just this sprightly, she was probably in her 30s, and dancing, I mean, she was obviously high, but she was just, I just wanted to embrace her. She didn't come in. She hasn't come in as far as I know, and that was maybe 6 years ago. She may be dead now. But she's a person like many other people I met, for whom I felt respect and attention. I mean, I felt like she had much to give me and did give to me. It wasn't me out there pitying her and giving her condoms, but she was in charge, and she chose to honor me with somehow some delightful experience. But I could see her pain, and that was another thing. She let me see her pain, which I found moving. The woman I was with that day, Sabrina, at that time had been clean and sober and out of prostitution for 3.5 years. We'd hired her after 2 years, which is our rule. We've since changed it to 3 years because 2 doesn't turn out to be enough. Sabrina is a very tall, beautiful, elegant African-American woman. A lot of style, a lot of power. She had been in the business for over 30 years and somehow survived, although her arms are full of scars and tracks, and she still has festering sores from old sites of injection. And she has AIDS, full-blown AIDS, and she's HIV positive. I mean, she's hepatitis C positive. So she's not got long to live. But she is such an effective worker. Prostitutes feel so attracted to her and grateful for her attention, and she's so good at teaching people like me how to be appropriate in the streets. And we could walk on some of the streets where we go. It looks like every store is closed and shuttered and empty, but a lot of them, in fact, have stuff going on in them. So she could walk into any one of those places, and everybody knew her, and everybody thought, if she brought me, I must be okay, and they'd be welcoming to me. And so she's been a great source of joy in my life, and has taught me a lot. Sabrina, in one of her recovery groups, AA groups, met a man and fell in love and went through a long falling in love, and I don't know if I can do this, and I'm pretty independent, and I've never had a real boyfriend before, and she has one grown son, but otherwise she had not had children. And finally she and he decided to get married. And so they had the best wedding. I got to do the flowers, so I bought lots of colorful stuff. And they got married in Sabrina's church, and she wore a white wedding gown with every doodad and train, and, the whole thing. And they played Here Comes the Bride. The audience, I mean, at the congregation was half recovery people and half street people. So her sort of former pals and her present pals. And we all just sobbed, you know. And Sabrina came down that aisle like the Queen of Sheba, and she looked so fabulous. And they've been married now for 3.5 years, and they're so happy. And she just can't believe it. She calls me up and says, "I'm still here in my apartment, with my kitchen and my bathroom and my bedroom." And she'll say, "And would you like to come over for lunch?" She's just, and it's a basement apartment, you know. It's not everybody would think they'd died and gone to heaven in that apartment, but boy, is she happy. And she continues, she's too ill to have a job now, but she works as a volunteer in Cook County Jail Women's Division, giving inspirational talks to women. Yeah. You know, she just says, I and she's an active member in her church, and oh, she's just, you know, and I think, if Genesis House had only existed for Sabrina, yeah, that would have been enough. They didn't have sex until they were married, and they didn't move in together until they were married. Mm-hmm. I mean, that tells you something. I don't know what it tells you, but it's important. So that's another model. That's a second person I wanted you to know about.
Has she ever written her story?
No, she's illiterate.
Yeah, or anybody else in that group? Because I work with women who are incarcerated, and some of them are prostitutes, and I'm always looking for something written or inspirational to give to them.
Yeah, she has actually written, someone has helped her write down a poem about her life.
Ooh.
And she would be happy to share that with you. She's a wonderful person. So that's another character that I would like you to have the image of in your life. And then there's another one, a third one I want to tell you about, whose name was Deborah Taylor. She was probably the first prostitute that I became really close to. She, when I met her, was a high-class businesswoman who worked the downtown hotels. And her cover, her dress, was the most classic Lord and Taylor business clothes you could imagine. She looked good. She was very classy. And she was articulate and funny and wore heavy gold jewelry and was very stylish and made a good living. But she was getting older. And I met her first when she was in court. I used to go to women's court and hang out in the hall outside women's court and talk to people who were waiting to go in before the judge or who would come out or, you know, who were out there. It was sort of a place to hang around out there. So I met her and we started talking. And the first time we met, we discovered that we'd had babies the same month, August, of the same summer. So we had daughters that were the same age. And we reminisced about what a hot summer it had been, and, you know, having a baby in August and all that stuff. We liked each other, we connected. So we talked some more. We arranged to meet a couple times. And then I said to her, "Will you come to my class of college students, my women's studies class about women and work, and talk about your work?" And she said yes, and so she came on time, dressed to the nines, and told her story. And she sort of slid off of the question of her children. And I knew she had this one daughter, and I had sort of gathered that she had more than one child. So she told this, she was entertaining, my students were eating out of her hand. They just loved her. She was funny, she was articulate, she was clear, she was, you know, she was fabulous, great teacher. And at the end of the hours, 2 hours, hour and a half, 2 hours, something like that, I walked her out onto the front porch of our office, and it was literally like someone took a hammer and smashed her face, and it was a mirror, and it just broke into pieces. You know, it was like, well, sometimes you see those in movies where her face just collapsed and fell apart, and she started to cry. And she said, "Ingrid, no one has ever paid attention to my story before. No one's ever listened to me. No one's ever really listened to my story, she said. And while you listened, I found out I don't like the ending. So she said, will you help me get out of the life? And I said, you know, I didn't know anything about how, but I'd be happy to accompany her. So she said, I'm going to make the decision soon. Well, Pamela didn't, as far as I know, make the decision soon, but she said she was going to. But Deborah Taylor did. She called me not 2 weeks later, at actually 5 a.m. And she said, she was sobbing, and I said to her, what is it? And she said, I'm on my third day cold turkey off heroin. Now, I didn't even know she was on heroin. I mean, I'm such a naive. So she said, I need help, and I need to come in. I need to find. But I knew enough about addiction stuff that I knew I shouldn't, like, hop in my car and rush over to wherever she was and rescue her. So I said, okay, well, let's meet at the office. I said, do you want to meet in a half an hour? In an hour? Do you have enough money to get to the office? Yes, she had enough money to get to the office. She didn't come until middle of the afternoon. So I went down to the office and waited and did other work, of course. And she finally came in. And she was, you know, all the things about withdrawal. And so I took her, talked to her and talked to her and talked to her, and then I took her to Genesis' house, who was wonderful, and took her in and immediately gave her a chocolate bar. I didn't know you were supposed to do that, but I guess, you know, I had a lot to learn. Turns out she couldn't read. This very articulate. I mean, you would have never guessed that she couldn't read. She obviously listens to the news. She listens to National Public Radio. I mean, she couldn't read. And she was an addict. And she had 3 children, and all 3 children had been taken away from her by the state. And her life was a bigger mess than I knew, or that I would have guessed. But she went into recovery, and she spent, you know, she went through a drug treatment program, and then she went to live at Genesis' house, and she spent a long time in recovery. And at the end of all of that time, she was reconciled with her children. They weren't living with her, but they were in good conversation, and they were living with a relative, and she saw them a lot, and she made a lot of her life right. And then she fell off the wagon and went back into the life. And statistically, that happens 3 times. So it's not surprising. She called me one more time, another early morning phone call. She never showed up again, and then she disappeared off the face of the earth. So I think there was some good in it. I think that it was good. She had a couple of good years, and during those good years, she loved everybody she needed to love, and she began to love herself, and she made amends for some things she'd done. And then addiction is a mean thing, and it got her. But that's another typical story. That's not a surprising story. So if you do this kind of work, you have to kind of plan on that. You can't get your hopes too high for anybody. A number of prostitutes have come here to Holden, and we've had Genesis House come 2 years now, and they'll come again this year in August. And Holden people really get attached to some of the individual women, and things go really well for some of them, and for others I have the news when I come back the next year that so-and-so's back in the life, has fallen off the wagon. So that is another kind of fact of life. I think I've said what I need to say except for my point 11. So, oh no, there's the legal spectrum. There are people who argue that it should be illegal. Over 80% of the women in Cook County Jail are there for nonviolent crimes. Prostitution and drug addiction are the primary ones. Stealing is another. But all those families that have been broken up, all those moms that have been taken away from those kids, you know, I just think that it's not really helpful to make it illegal, to incarcerate, to constantly be spending our resources, our security resources on prostitutes. Just, to me, doesn't compute. There are people who say we could legalize it. Legalizing it would mean, it would be sort of like a butcher shop, you know, where you inspect and stamp with approval, and I don't think that's healthy. I don't think it should be legalized, because I think it's bad for people. I think it's a bad thing. Prostitution is bad. And if we legalize it, we're saying some people in our society are expendable. We can certify them to go into this profession, which I think is evil. I think it's a wrong thing to do. And that only leaves, the only other thing we could think of is non-regulation. And that would mean, if you didn't regulate prostitution, except, of course, all the laws that are already on the books to protect youth, so it would never be legal for, you would arrest people who sexually molested youth, just as we're supposed to do now, or rape, you would arrest people who raped people. I mean, we have laws on the books that cover a lot of circumstances. But if it was non-regulated, what I would recommend is that we figure out how to improve the education system so that everybody learns how to read and write and compute. We try to figure out who's in a family where they're being abused. It's not so hard to figure out. Teachers often know. Family members know, but if we could have a healthy way of treating that so that there's got to be some effective action a society can take against abuse to children. If we had jobs, if as a society we made a priority for not efficiency, but for high employment, I think that would make a difference. If we could figure out, I mean, I do these classes with prostitutes at Genesis House of court-referred prostitutes, and I always start out with an asset survey. Tell us what your head, heart, and hands are good at. And they have wonderful stories about the things that they're good at and all the assets they have, and how much they loved computer studies in high school, or how much they love baking bread, or they love caring for elderly, or doing hair, or... And I sometimes say, what is your dream job? What would you love to do? And their dream jobs are real achievable. They're not fancy. They're just like doing hair or nails or cooking or caring for elderly. I mean, they want to do regular things. They're not different human beings because they do prostitution from the rest of us. They're the same. They're beloved children of God. They're regular. They want to do regular things. They don't want any prostitution. But then the other thing we would have to do as a society is put a priority on drug treatment. Because there's so many thousands and thousands of people that are drug addicts that need treatment. And there's long lines in every treatment facility, and the treatment is ineffective because it's too short. And you know, we don't make it a priority. So I think if we did non-regulation, we would have to... It wouldn't do any good unless we did the other thing.
I just like to add something to you. Most people I would have a chemical dependency, and oftentimes there's an underlying mental health issue.
Yeah.
As you probably did, you mean that?
No, I didn't.
You know, like bipolar.
Dual diagnosis. So.
Exactly. So that needs to be addressed too.
And really, the federal funding has been cut and cut in this area. It's one of the casualties of September 11th. So, you know, there's less and less available to help women who are working.
September 11th is the excuse, not the reason.
Yeah,
right.
Of course it is. But it was a real handy excuse for the Bush administration.
Uh-huh. Would you decriminalize or legalize drugs?
I don't know. I haven't thought it through. I don't know. And I'm not sure that I would think the first step with prostitution would be to take.
No, I'm not saying as a first step, but as part of this whole series of steps that mm-hmm. you're talking about.
If we could just...
If you can take the profit motive out of yeah. the drug trade.
Yeah.
What percentage of the prostitutes are under, say, either 18 or 21?
I actually just saw that number this afternoon. Let's see if I can remember it. It's something like 24.
So if you went down your proposal, you would at best be 3/4 legalizing.
Yeah, about that. Not legalizing, but non-regulating. But that would be, I mean, those are the women that have families that are in prison.
Correct. You would, there are laws in the book that say it's illegal. You would have to change those laws, which would be legalizing. And whether you regulate it or not is another question.
But I guess that's a question of semantics.
Well, okay.
Did I see a hand over here?
Well, I was just going to ask, and partially answered there, if you took the, if you're able to turn off the spigot and not have homeless children and kids that were brought up and sexually assaulted and that as a young age, how much would that impact prostitution? Or is it a vacuum that would get filled up by more adults?
You know, because almost every prostitute is a product of that kind of life experience, it seems like it would just make an enormous difference because people wouldn't be willing to do this work if they didn't have that kind of underlaying of a psychological experience and violence. So I think that would be huge.
I'm wondering what the experience is in places like Amsterdam, where isn't it legalized and they're not just non-regulated, I think it's even regulated there.
Well, there's some state in the union that where it is. Nevada, maybe?
In Nevada, yes. I don't know what the experience is there, although I've just seen the signs. It's amazing.
Yeah. I've heard some women from there talk about how it comes down to you can't join the church choir. You're not supposed to have a life outside of the brothel. So if you want to have a vacation, you have to leave the state. You can't sort of work 8-hour days and then go and be in the church choir and have a regular life. I don't know enough about it to know what exactly they mean by those stories, but I got the sense that it was regulated, that they paid if they were going to go out and be regular people.
Well, when you suggest that we legalize it, it's so that we quit wasting resources trying to stop it. It's not that legalizing would change anything. It stops wasting our police officers' efforts to...
Right, but then, of course, I would want that to be paired with redirecting the resources.
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there's another place. Uh-huh.
What do Johns have anything in common that...
I don't know much about them. I do know that some of them make, you know, don't seem to have much going for them except that they have a stable of women that they make a living from and that they seem violent and cruel and mean. I know that outside of the house where we teach the classes to the court-referred women, that there's often a line of cars with men waiting in it, you know, letting the women go through their court-referred class, and then their Johns are out there picking them up.
Oh, that's pimp. John, the pimp.
Oh, no, that's the pimp, John, sorry. No, the John, the clients. Oh, the clients. It's a mystery to me. I mean, I think of love as being, a sex as being a sort of intimate, cherishing, personal, sweet, communicative. But I'm always mystified by these stories in the Bible where men have sex with women and don't know who they are, and they're their daughter or their daughter-in-law, or, you know, there's always stories in the Bible where men are having sex with people that they know really well and they don't recognize the person. So, I mean, I just don't understand that whole mentality. Yes, Anne.
I think, or just one thought there, and I think there's a real problem just psychologically with sometimes with being able to have both lust and love for the same partner. That they split. You can love one person but not lust for them.
Yeah.
And so your lust is fulfilled with your mistress or prostitute, and your love is reserved for your partner.
There has to be something like that going on, but maybe the men in the room could speak to it. I don't know how that works.
Uh-huh. What has been your experience with the effect of having children? My only intersection is working with teen mothers, and for some of those young women, maybe they were those 14-year-olds, and then because they you know, have to be in school or something, and they suddenly they're kind of jerked out of whatever the experience was, and maybe the pimp doesn't want them around, and they're pregnant, and they're pretty soon they're gone. So have people talked, I mean, for the girls I work with, which are a pretty narrow range, lots of them talk about how their child really saved them.
I think there's some of that, and there are other stories that I've heard actually quite a few times. Deborah Taylor's story is actually the case. When she and I hooked up and found out about this birth of our daughters at that point were 13, and she said that she wanted to go into recovery to get her daughter back, to prevent her daughter from going into the work. And so there was something about the age when she was put out on the street by her father. And then when her daughter got to be that age, even though she didn't have custody of her daughter, she suddenly got frantic to try to do something to change. Mm-hmm. So I think children do have a sort of redeeming influence on a lot of people. And people talk about their children with such tenderness and longing. And I think it's probably time for me to do number 11, which is to tell you about another woman that I knew as who lived at Genesis House for a little bit, and she was a client there a lot. She would come in off the street almost daily for a long time, and her name was Dakota. She was an elderly. She looked elderly. In actual fact, it turns out she wasn't so old, but her life had been hard, and she had cataracts in her eyes, so she was nearly blind, and she continued to turn tricks and to be an addict. But she came to Genesis House, and she really loved having a kitchen to work in, which is true of so many prostitutes, that they have, I mean, they love cleaning the bathroom. Just to have a home, a place to go where they can do something useful. And they love having a safe place to sit around the dining room table and joke around and eat food that they've prepared or that they've helped prepare. But Dakota was really one who felt very strongly about this. And I was very attached to her. So I wrote this little piece about her and I wanted to read it to you. Dakota, it's called Dakota Who Is Dead Now. Dakota, who is dead now, came in the dead of winter to this place of hope called Genesis House, wanting, well, she wanted to sweep the kitchen floor, the hall, the stair, the classroom in the basement. Then she wanted to slice the potatoes, the carrots, even the onions for the soup. And then she wanted to clean the counters. With her TB cough and her sores from AIDS, to make the counters of our kitchen completely clean. Dakota, who is dead now, asked in her seldom used voice, not more than a whisper, could she come to the class with the ladies? The ladies were arriving by then, no whispers there, loud, walking all over the carefully swept stairs and the sliced vegetables, robust, swaggering, laughing, prostitutes all, and Dakota, who is dead now, watched from her corner and saw what she saw. Her dark eyes blue with cataracts. She picked lightly at my arm and whispered, could I go to the clothes room? Because of the cold, I handed her wool. Wool sweaters, wool pants, looking for something small enough to fit her small, dying body. When I turned to face her, I saw that she had put on them all, four sweaters and three pants, and still she was so small. Dakota, who is dead now, said when I asked her, why do you come and clean in this place and chop the vegetables so intently? She said in her whisper, it is the only place where I can. She was found in some other place, outdoors, unconscious, and the only words on her body were our words, Janice's house, a place of hope for all women. Whether she found hope here, I don't know. She came often and swept and chopped and watched, sometimes with a small smile, and layered up in the clothes room and shyly gave thanks. For in life, it was all she had. And Dakota, dear Dakota, she is dead now. Thank you for coming. Mm-hmm.